From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, we focus on news from two Latin American countries, the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela and the Central American nation of Guatemala. In Venezuela, the country's socialist president, Nicolas Maduro, declared a national emergency for 60 days Friday, hours before he was set to deliver his annual address to the nation before a new National Assembly that had pledged to seek his removal after last month's elections placed the right-wing opposition in its control. The president declared a nationwide economic emergency Friday, just hours ahead of a key speech in front of that body, where he set to propose a package of reforms. The emergency was declared in compliance with the Constitution for a period of 60 days and was released shortly after noon local time. It detailed the economic war that's been waged against Venezuela and declared a need for serious measures to restore economic security. The economic emergency involves making resources from the 2015 financial year available, assigning extra funds to health, education, food, and housing, designing and implementing measures to prevent tax evasion, and giving the president the, quote, authorization to address the causes of the current situation, closed quote. The declaration was published just hours before Maduro was expected to deliver his annual address, beginning around 5 p.m. local time on Friday. Socialist legislator Hector Rodriguez said the president's speech will outline a new stage of the Bolivarian Revolution and invited the people of Venezuela to join him. Friday's address will be Maduro's first State of the Union speech in front of the country's new National Assembly. The right wing secured a majority there during elections in December and have since vowed to seek to oust Maduro from office. Maduro himself has said he will continue to fight for the country's socialist revolution and accused the new National Assembly of seeking to roll back economic gains of the past decade.
Discurso del señor Jimmy Morales Cabrera, presidente constitucional de la República.
Guatemala inaugurated a new president, Jimmy Morales, a former TV comic, elected on a wave of public anger against corruption. Morales took office Thursday in a ceremony attended by senior officials from around the region. Among those invited were U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and the presidents of Mexico, Ecuador, and most Central American countries. Spain's former King Juan Carlos was also in attendance. Morales was previously known for a TV role as a country bumpkin who nearly becomes president. Elections last October elevated him to the office of head of state for real and by a landslide, despite his having no previous political experience except for an unsuccessful run for municipal office in 2011. His victory was attributed to widespread public disgust with corruption, especially after his elected predecessor, Otto Perez, was removed in the midst of a major corruption scandal. Morales has very little political support in the Congress, where his conservative party holds just 11 of the 158 seats. Guatemala is the largest economy in Central America, but has some of the worst figures for poverty and social exclusion. It also suffers from a history of military coups and genocide. For more on this, we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, who spoke with us via Skype
here
from
in Central America. The most important event of the last few days has been the inauguration of Jimmy Morales, the new president of Guatemala. And that was attended by representatives from the region. For the United States, the Vice President Joe Biden headed the U.S. delegation. And I think also the President of Costa Rica was there. It was the Vice President of Nicaragua who took part for Nicaragua. But I was surprised that there weren't many regional heads of state, and a lot of the countries in the region sent vice presidents or other representatives,
foreign ministers or whatever.
So and that was a little curious, because normally you'd have expected, you know, for for such an important event in Central America, in the Central American region, you'd have expected everybody to have turned up, all the regional leaders to have turned up. But anyway,
why don't we talk about that, though? Let's give people a little background about why it was important.
Well, it was important because, and people may remember that last year Guatemala was racked by severe discontent with mass demonstrations against the corruption that was prevalent in different areas of Guatemala's public life, but particularly in the government. And so, and that was tied in with regional intervention by the United States, in particular in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, trying to stop those countries shifting leftwards, if you like, to use that term. And they've been very successful because, right, in the case of Guatemala, they were able, and from my point of view, it was very clear that the issue of corruption was being very much manipulated, both in Guatemala and in Honduras.
Right.
And we, perhaps in another program we can talk about the situation in Honduras. But
yeah.
And what happened in Guatemala was that these mass demonstrations in the street led to demands for the first senior figures in Otto Perez, the then president's circle, to be brought to book, which they were. And subsequently, Otto Perez himself was detained and subject to judicial process. And he's actually still facing those charges. And
right,
it's not clear what the end result will be, but it's not looking good for Otto Perez.
Right.
Otto Perez himself, talking to RT, the RT media outlet, gave a long interview in which he explicitly argued that he was very much a victim of intervention, external intervention by the United States, and the corruption for investigating, the Commission for Investigating Corruption in Guatemala, which is a UN body very much under the thumb of the United States and its allies.
Yeah, you had it right the first time. Corruption investigating corruption.
Right. Yeah. Well, absolutely. No, in the region, the UN has very little credibility, largely because of its complete failure to address the deep needs of people in Haiti, for example. That's just one example.
Au contraire. Right.
And then what happened in the subsequent election, and again, it's actually quite curious. Otto Perez was removed from office just weeks before a general election, slightly different, because it was a military coup in Honduras. But the same thing happened in Honduras in 2009 when President Manuel Zelaya was forcibly removed from office by the military just a month before the election. I mean, it's just
Ukraine, anyway, too, right? I mean, it was an election year that Yanukovych got ousted in a coup as well. The presidential election was supposed to be at the end of that year. They could have waited.
Right. So I mean, it looks as though what's happened. Yes, I mean, it seems to be very much that what's happening are these are kind of soft coups, if you like,
right,
or variants on different levels of forceful seizure of the state or overthrow of the existing authorities.
Well, the salient part of that is that as you accomplish this soft coup, you are now conducting the election. You are staffing the electoral commissions and all of this, and so, you know, the election is being conducted under your control, and that's an entirely different condition that existed before the coup.
Yeah, and even if it may be the case in Guatemala, for example, that the electoral authority was already in place, but the mere fact that the powers that be and the sinister behind the scenes powers that be went after Otto Perez sent a very strong message to everybody in the Guatemalan establishment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, either you toe the line, either you conform to what we want. or you could be next.
Yeah, ask Poroshenko about that. He should be watching that, especially with the polls that came out recently in Ukraine.
Right.
You know, because he's not performing there. The United States can yank him and put in somebody else.
Well, let's say that Ukraine is way past my grade level, I'm afraid.
No, it's very similar to what you're describing. That's why I brought it up. The similarities may not be obvious, but you do have this condition where there was a presidential election scheduled for that year, and there was a coup months before so that the election would be conducted under the coup government. That was true in Honduras and in Guatemala and in Ukraine.
Oh, yeah, and something that in relation to that, and I think it's worth pointing out that in relation to kind of comparing what's been happening in Central America and other parts of the region, for example, the attempts at a soft coup in Brazil, and the constant attempts at destabilizing Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina. And often people commenting on the region will suggest that there's something new in all this, that there's some kind of new technique, new use of the media or new use of some other element. But if you look back at over the last 50, 60, 70 years at the way the United States and its allies, in particular the United Kingdom, have destabilized governments. And if you look at what happened to Mossadegh, there was the same kind of soft power preparation, softening up the population to prepare conditions for the ultimate blow of the coup.
Or Benz, too, for that matter. I mean, just in that country, they did it exactly that way. They leafleted places with all kinds of stories about our Benz. You know, planes would just drop leaflets on a town, and that was how they conducted their propaganda war then. But they softened the whole population up the same way.
Yeah, and that was just a year after the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in 1954.
That's right.
And the history is very clear. And while it may be true that there may be more emphasis, much stronger emphasis now on the kind of the soft coup elements, the soft elements, the media elements, the psychological warfare elements, the economic warfare elements, very similar to what happened in Chile. And while there may be more emphasis on those elements now than on the element of sheer military force, essentially it's just a reconfiguration of elements that have always existed in U.S. and allied attempts to destabilize governments who resist their will.
If you look at the force, they do use force when they want to, either Libya, Syria, you know, by proxy, directly. It's there. It's in the quiver.
Oh, it's always there. And in particular, perhaps when we get to talk about some Venezuela, we'll look at that as well. But then sticking to Guatemala for the moment, and the reason the election of Jimmy Morales was important is because, and he was a right-wing figurehead from a very, very much funded by extreme right-wing military or retired military in Guatemala. And it bears repeating constantly that the military in Guatemala are not just a military. They're also a very powerful economic force because they own banks, they own supermarket chains, they own transport businesses, public bus businesses, and all kinds of businesses within the Guatemalan economy are actually owned by holding companies related to the Guatemalan military. And the fact that Jimmy Morales was able to project himself as a Mr. Clean, if you like, in terms of Guatemala's political class,
right,
was very much a kind of sleight of hand, a trick by extremely reactionary elements in the Guatemalan elite,
right,
to get their man in.
Right.
And they managed to convince enough people in Guatemala to give Morales a quite a significant win. I think he got as much as 60% of the vote in the election.
Yeah, out of the group that they usually front, he hasn't committed genocide. He only slays them in nightclubs. He's a comedian, right? Isn't it?
Right, yeah. But he's very much associated with the retired military who were responsible for genocide through the 1980s.
Is he like the Bob Hope of Guatemala?
Well, and if you like, yeah, and the road to Guatemala.
Yeah, right, there you go.
So, And there he is. Now, he won the election fair and square, and it seems that he does have a genuine popular mandate on the basis of fighting corruption and reducing poverty. That was basically his electoral platform, and also that constant element that the right wing tend to play on the let's change, let's do something new, yes we can, you know, all that right-wing right. nonsense, because, right. just to kind of fool people into believing that something might change.
Well, that again, you had essentially at the very beginning, even when the discontent was being whipped up against him, it was devoid of any ideological content. It was corruption, like this generic thing that has no apparent ideological content. And so, you know, at the end of the day, when you're looking for an expression of justice against this, well, it can be defined by whoever has the microphone.
Right. Yeah, and I think the constant presence of Joe Biden, I mean, he makes regular interventions in what people in Central America call the Northern Triangle, which is Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And the presence of Biden at Jimmy Morales's inauguration sends a very strong message that the United States is going to maintain the level of its intervention in Guatemala, and will be constantly looking over Jimmy Morales' shoulder to make sure he doesn't step out of line. But the fundamental thing for Morales is that he's become the president of a country with levels of poverty running at 60%. And that's an incredible figure, and even worse when you realize that the measure of poverty that's applied is a measure of poverty. I know, what is it, $1.50 income a day per person?
Yeah, much.
You know, and that it's a level of poverty so low that it does not fairly reflect the actual levels of deprivation in Guatemala.
Right.
And also the other thing that's affecting Guatemala to a similar degree that this phenomenon is also affecting Honduras and perhaps to a diminishing extent El Salvador, is the level of violent crime. And Guatemala has a level of violent crime of, I think it's 30 homicides per 100,000 inhabitants now, which is, you know, in Latin America, that's extremely high, and I don't know what the figure is in the United States. I mean, when one talks about the United States, one has to talk about individual cities and individual states, really, doesn't
it? Yeah,
one?
Like New York City, they all have murder rates, then, and they actually track them as part of all of the crap you get at the end of the year about this was a record year for balloons, this was a record year for the New York Giants, this was a record year for this and that. They also have the murder rates. You know, it's like, New York had a record low murder rate this year.
Right, okay. Well, and that's the level of delinquent violence in Guatemala as reflected by its homicide rate, 30 per 100,000, which in Latin America is quite high. And very similar to the rate in Honduras. I think Guatemala vies with Honduras as being one of the most violent countries in Latin America. So Jimmy Morales is taking that over, and his program of government is that he's going to root out corruption, he's going to diminish the levels of violence and increase citizen security, and he's going to diminish levels of poverty. But, and it's very hard, and particularly on that last area, it's very hard to see how he's going to make a difference in 4 years, given the neoliberal policies that of which he is an aficionado. Because, and I think we mentioned this in an earlier program, a couple of weeks to maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and Honduras and Guatemala are actually showing figures of an increase in poverty over the last 5 years. And for Jimmy Morales to turn that around in 4 years is like, you know, it's a fantasy. He's not going to do it. He may he may be able to create conditions that may lead to some lessening of poverty. But in his own presidential term, he's certainly not going to bring down the levels of poverty in Guatemala. And it's extremely unlikely that the policy mix that he has in mind is going to work, unless he takes a leaf out of the book of the Sandinista government of President Daniel Ortega here in Nicaragua, or the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, or the policies implemented by Rafael Correa in Ecuador, or Evo Morales in Bolivia. Unless, you know, there's no way that the policies promoted by Joe Biden and his United States diplomatic and economic team, that they're encouraging Guatemala to follow. There's absolutely no chance at all that those policies are going to diminish poverty in Guatemala. If anything, they're going to make it worse.
Those policies are basically stick them up and give me your money. I mean, how could they possibly help?
Well, and they'll say, oh, well, we're going to create employment. And, you know, and so they'll open up. They'll open up the way for mining corporations, for example, or they'll try and compete. They'll try and become more competitive in the maquila, but kind of pushing down wage levels, you know, to try and attract foreign investments in what's called the maquila. That these kind of what do you call them there in English? And they're just very low level manufacturing operations that import already prepared material like textiles, already cut, just needing to be assembled, so that they can then be re-exported as if they were a product of Guatemala, you know. And that's In Central America has been a leading center of the maquila for a long time, kind of 10, 15, getting on for 20 years now, because of its proximity to the U.S. market. Perhaps we should take advantage of that angle to start talking about what's happening in Venezuela.
Yes. Yeah, we can do that. The election, I guess. A lot of this stuff happened in the past week, right? You had last week, I guess before that, we had a decision by the Venezuelan Supreme Court to not allow four of the people that were elected to the National Assembly in December to take their seats. Three of them belong to the opposition group. This is while the case is being litigated over voter fraud. Three of them are from the opposition group, one from the Socialist Party, and with the opposition group, it put them below the two-thirds majority necessary for a good part of their agenda. It puts them strategically in a different place than just that, because whatever plan they may have had to take over the country, force Maduro out, and all of that had, I'm sure, a certain sequence of events. And now that sequencing is messed up because they can't do any of the things you require a two-thirds majority for. The underlying case are allegations, including evidence such as tape recordings of a phone conversation, of actual vote buying. So that's where we're at the moment.
Yeah, and of course, under Venezuela's electoral law, vote buying is a very serious criminal offense.
Yep.
Whereas in countries like Central America and other countries of the Caribbean, in particular Haiti, vote buying is kind of accepted as standard practice, and you know, there's never even a whiff of any chance of a prosecution of that kind of irregularity in those countries. Yeah. And the procedure that's been followed in Venezuela is an indication of Venezuela's the stability of Venezuela's legal system, and the stability of its political system, the stability of its electoral system. And
yep.
So,
you know, what was interesting too, I mean, you can see an expression of that in what happened in the last week, which is when the National Assembly was seated, it was a week ago, Tuesday, I think, they swore in the people who the Supreme Court had said could not take office. They defied the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court then said, essentially, if you're taking in people illegally, then you're constituted illegally, and any actions that you take on anything are illegal and void. And they backed down over that because they realized that there was a legal basis to undermine everything that they would do in that assembly.
Yeah, and that's a very important victory, not for Nicolas Maduro, although implicitly it is very
sure.
positive for Nicolas Maduro and the Venezuelan United Socialist Party, but it's actually a victory for the Venezuelan people and the Venezuela's institutional stability.
Yep.
Because and that is why is it important, an important victory in that sense, because the Venezuelan opposition are absolutely committed to destroying Venezuela's institutional stability. That mm-hmm. is one of their main objectives. And
yep.
they've been very clear in saying that they're going to create the conditions to unseat Nicolas Maduro within the next 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're determined to remove him from office. You know, as though the legislature, you know, is as though that's a faculty of the legislature. What's the job of any legislature? Their job is to frame laws, debate laws, pass laws that promote the peace and prosperity and security of their people. And that's, you know, that's the same in Venezuela. But in Venezuela, what the legislature have taken upon themselves is that they're going to be the arbiters of who should be the government and who should not.
Right.
You know, which is, you know, it's completely unconstitutional
exactly.
anywhere in any stable country. So, but that's what the opposition are trying to do, and so that's why it was important, very important, for the Venezuela's equivalent of the Supreme Court to set a mark and say, well, look, if you don't abide by the law, nothing that you do as a legislature will be legal. And they had to back down. That's very, very important.
Yep.
So then, I've been reading a little bit around the current situation in Venezuela, and I was also very lucky to have quite a long conversation with the editor of Axis of Logic, Les Blow, who lives in Venezuela, and Les was explaining to me that one of the interesting things in Venezuela's constitution is that there's a provision for a parallel people's assembly.
Yeah.
That's parallel to the formal national legislature. And I don't know in any detail what the real political power of that assembly is. I suspect that it's more a body that provides a kind of moral control rather than a legally precise control over the activities in the national legislature.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very important body in terms of enabling the people to express themselves should the national assembly, the formal legislature of the country,
right.
Get hijacked in a way that is contrary to the interests of the people of Venezuela. So it'll be interesting to see over the next month or so how the role of that popular national assembly, parallel to the legislature, the country's legislature, actually develops. And I think that's a very important legacy of the genius of Comandante Hugo Chavez. So yeah, and let's see how that mechanism develops in Venezuela, and because under the previous institutional setup, where the National Assembly was controlled by a party that supported the government, that the role of that assembly was not so crucial in terms of defending the interests of ordinary people in Venezuela. But now,
right.
it's likely to come to the fore and may well play a crucial role in defending the interests of ordinary people, especially working people in Venezuela.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.